Hello and welcome to the Humans Invent Cycling podcast. My name is Lionel Burney and I'm joined by Daniel Freed.
Hi Lionel.
Richard Moore is still away, but we'll battle on without him, like Trek Factory Racing without Fabian Cancellara. So we've got a packed podcast again this week, following what must be the busiest racing weekend of the season. You need eyes in the back of your head just to keep up with it. There have been three semi-classics in Belgium as we head towards the big one, which is the Tour of Flanders on Sunday, and the stage races have been at the Tour of Catalonia in northeastern Spain. Plus, there have been a couple of minor stage races in Corsica and Italy, and the second round of the Women's World Cup. Actually, there's no way you can keep up with all of it, but your best chance is right here on the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
So, shall we start in Belgium, Daniel? We had Dwars Door Vlaanderen, which was won by Nicky Terpstra of Amiga Pharma Quickstep. Then the Grand Prix E3 Harelbeke, which was won by Peter Sagan. And then Gent-Wevelgem won by John Degenkolb. What did you make of the three races we've seen this week? The Cobbles Classics are truly getting underway now, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think, as has been the case with regard to these three races for maybe a couple of years now, E3 was probably the standout one. Probably the most interesting course now of those three, and the finale was really very exciting indeed, with Geraint Thomas really sort of started off the hostilities on the Quaremont and ended up getting away with four. Well, there was a four-man group with Thomas, two Quickstep riders, Vandenbergen, Terpstra, and Peter Sagan. And Sagan looked like he was really struggling on the Quaremont, was dropped, and we learned later that he'd been riding on one of his teammates' bikes, Alan Marangoni. He had a problem with his rear derailleur, I think. And, Sagan looked beaten. He really didn't. And at this point, Cancellara was also well out the back. He'd got caught behind a crash. But Sagan then proceeded to absolutely ride rings round the other four in the finale, in the sense that, you know, Quickstep obviously had the numerical advantage, and this just shows that for all that we may refer to Quickstep as the kind of Galacticos of the classics, and they seem to have such strength in depth, if you haven't got a finisher, to continue the footballing analogy, there's not a lot you can do. And you know, they really should have won in that situation, but Sagan, I mean, I don't think it's in every race that you'll come across a guy who's that strong and is able to mark those moves, because Thomas really didn't do an awful lot. There were a few pundits criticised him for, you know, I think he went after Vandenberg with about 1.5 kilometres to go. But really, I think he played it fairly smartly, Geraint Thomas, but Sagan was simply too strong.
Yeah, to take that analogy further, I mean, Sagan basically hung around the goal and then stuck the winner in the 90th minute, didn't he?
But I'm not sure, but I think he took it from from his own penalty area, dribbled around the entire opposing team and backheeled it in on the line, I think.
It just showed, though, didn't it? I mean, but it was by far the best race of the three, E3. Dwars Door Vlaanderen was notable for Terpstra's well-timed move, and Quickstep, they played all of their cards perfectly. Tyler Farrar, who won the sprint for second, thumped his handlebars in a kind of theatrical show of frustration. But really, the reason he was frustrated was because the chase group in Dwars Door Vlaanderen didn't bring that Terpstra move back. But if they had cooperated and brought that move back, then the Quicksteps would have played multiple other cards. They had so many other options to play with. So Terpstra really benefited from that, in a little bit like Stijn de Volder did in the Tour of Flanders a couple of times, being the kind of decoy card and then moving away. And then, as you say, in Harelbeke, they put two men in the decisive break. The key was Thomas made that effort on the Quaremont to get rid of Cancellara and put him at a disadvantage and make him chase. Obviously, he hoped that Sagan would not make the cut, but he dug incredibly deep to get back in. And then, as you say, the numerical advantage that Amiga Pharma Quickstep had, and the fact that Sagan was going to be the quickest finisher, Thomas was sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place, really. And like you say, he did what he could do. There wasn't a great deal else he could have done, because he wasn't going to outsprint Sagan. And I think that just shows that even when he looks beaten at a certain point, if you take Peter Sagan to the finish, you know, you're very unlikely to beat him.
Yeah, and not just the finish in terms of, you know, the last 500 metres or the last 200 metres when he might be sprinting, but the last sort of 5 kilometres of a race when the attacks start to go. I mean, we saw this last year at Brabant's Appeal, Montreal. We saw it again at Wevelgem, where he was the rider on the front foot attacking to win in those races, but he's also fantastic in a defensive position, despite having a pretty weak team. And the same, I think, probably weaker than Cancellara's team. I think Quickstep probably look at both of those riders' teams and think, you know, that's where we have a clear advantage. But, you know, the great thing about the classics is, unlike the mountain stages on the Tour where you could, or in stage races where you could pretty much plot before the race where everyone is, and you could predict with a great degree of certainty who is going to be there and when each of the riders is going to fall out the back. At the classics, you will always find there will always be one guy who's on a great day you don't expect to be there. So, you know, it's fine saying, okay, we'll isolate Cancellara and Sagan, but then, you know, two BMC riders might find themselves in the front group, two Orica Green Edge riders, and so on and so on. So it's really not an exact science.
No, and I think looking back at the way Geraint Thomas he shredded the rest of the field, didn't he? And they closed down the leading riders were obviously tired. They'd been out in front a long time. But Thomas did look very impressive on the Quadamont. It's interesting that he chose that as a place, not just because of its strategic positioning in the race, but also the longer, more gradual climb, rather than choosing to make his big effort on one of the steeper climbs. Do you think that tells us anything about how he may approach the Tour of Flanders coming up?
I mean, I think the Quaremont tends to get lumped together with the other bergs, the other cobbled climbs, but it's actually, as you know, it's very, very different. It's almost in a category of its own. It's about 2 kilometres long, not very steep at all, and it's almost a... although riders like Cancellara have thrived there in the past, it is quite different from... and you often see different riders going very, very well there. But, yeah, he was certainly extremely impressive to the extent that he looked like he was going to... he was in a good position to dominate the race when he did that, but it wasn't to be. I mean, Sky have lost Stannard this weekend. It looks like we're just awaiting news of his fitness for the Tour of Flanders, but he crashed at Gent-Wevelgem, very sort of dangerous, hairy race. Gent-Wevelgem turned out to be, he crashed, Thomas crashed, but I think Thomas is going to be fit for Flanders. But that's a major loss. I mean, I thought that Stannard represented their best chance at Flanders. Now they've still got obviously Boasten Hagen, and you know they've got a decent backup team of people like Bernie Eisel, very very experienced. But Boasten Hagen, after a very promising start to the sort of Belgian campaign, he was third in Het Nieuwsblad, is sort of flattered to deceive a little bit.
Yeah, you mentioned also there the older Quadamont, which, you know, it plays a completely different role in the Tour of Flanders. It's much more of the kind of part of the whittling down process. And the reason it's so so difficult is because, as you say, it's long, it's shallow. There's quite a tricky approach to it. There's a tight corner at the bottom, so everybody's kind of going from quite a slow pace when they hit the cobbles at the bottom. And then if you've ever stood there and watched either Het Nieuwsblad or E3 or the Tour of Flanders, the bunch always comes past in a long line, just from number one to number 200. It's just one of those climbs that just really sorts everybody out, and there's really no sort of bunching at all. Whereas you see them on the Pattersberg or Koppenberg, you know, maybe the first 10, 15 will come over in a single file. Then it kind of fans out across the road, and every man kind of fights for the a little bit of road where they can get a clear line. On the Quaremont, the pace is always on. It's always, you know, incredibly fast. And I mean, if you want to see kind of the way they ride on these cobbles, that's probably one of the best vantage points to go and watch, I would say. But looking ahead at the Tour of Flanders, we're going to see the real heavyweights, Tom Boonen and Fabian Cancellara and the like, come to the fore. I mean, do you see any further than those two for the victory?
Well, I mean, I think obviously the three standout favourites, Cancellara, Boonen and Sagan, you know, a few people have put Sepp van Marck in that group. I don't really see him in that category yet, although he has looked good. I mean, there's always the chance that, you know, a Sky rider, BMC rider, there are various other outsiders who could be a factor. But on the evidence of the races we've seen so far, I think even I would pare it down to Sagan and Cancellara as being the real outstanding favourites. Boonen has sat on most of the time. I mean, they've had the advantage, Omega Pharma Quickstep, of Terpstra being incredibly strong and almost too strong at times, looking a little bit impetuous, sort of like the kind of Cancellara of the sort of best and worst days, when he tends to be too strong and consequently sort of disincentivizes people to work for him and work with him.
Yeah, Terpstra, it's going to be interesting, isn't it? If he gets an opportunity to go, there's going to be no holding him back. He strikes me a little bit as in the same role as De Volder from a few years ago, when Quickstep had Stijn De Volder. Obviously now De Volder's with Cancellara, so he'll be an important part of Trek Factory Racing's strategy, no doubt. But yeah, Terpstra is kind of the wild card for me, I think. If something happens in the race with a sort of 40-50 kilometres to go mark, that's that kind of penultimate move is the one that sometimes succeeds, and Terpstra is going to be the man that's lighting it up from that sort of 220k to go mark, I would have thought. Recently I spoke to Sebastian Langeveldt, who won that race in 2011, I think. He's been 5th and 10th in the Tour of Flanders. He's now riding with the Garmin Sharp team, and he's an outside shot for the podium, perhaps. Not really seen a great deal of him yet this season, but I spoke to him because I wanted to know firsthand what the race is like to ride.
First of all, it's a monument in cycling. It's, yeah, I think one of the biggest races from the season. In Flanders, it's like a national holiday. It's everybody's out, and I'm from Holland, but still, you know, it's not far from Holland. And when I grow up, it's just, I grow up with that race. Every time it was on television, love it. It's I love racing in that particular part of Belgium, and yeah, and it's also something, I think you have to be, you know, you're born with a sort of a talent, and those races, that's where I'm good at, and I try to get my results there.
When you were growing up then and learning about cycling and getting interested in it, was it one of the races that you watched on TV that particularly captured you?
Yeah, one of my favourites was always Rolf Sørensen. He won a race in 1997, I think. Paris-Roubaix, Tour of Flanders, Milan-San Remo. It's a really interesting part of the season, the Spring Classics. And yeah, I try to focus on them every year. It's really hard because every year the level's getting up and teams are not sending just guys to do that race. They want some results also because of the point system. And yeah, I'm targeting them.
In the most recent years, the course has changed quite dramatically. The old finish from the Mur and the Bosberg and into Ninove has gone, and now with the circuit finish, what's your impression of the changes they've made? Do you think it's for the better, or did it make it more difficult?
Yeah, every race is free to, you know, change it, and I think people has to get used to it, because Milan-San Remo's race for so many years, you have Cipressa, Poggio, first the Capos, and you know, I think every time they change the race, everybody's like, "Whoa, what's going on?" I think a change in Flanders, you just gonna give it a couple of years and see what it is. I think the last 2 years wasn't too good. The course was really closed, and everybody was waiting for the last, you know, last Quaremont, last Paterberg. We did a recon from Flanders already in December, and I think this year the race is more open and there are more points to race. Yeah, I think the change they did this year to the course, it's going to be good.
Do you have a favourite climb or a favourite section of cobbles that you particularly look forward to, or one that maybe will make the race?
You always have climbs that suit you a little bit better, or you're always struggling a little bit. I found it out in the past, the most important thing is you got to have your form and your condition, and then you're going good on all those climbs. And especially when you do those climbs in December, it's not fun. It's because you're just struggling with it. But I like the old Quaremont. That's a little bit longer one, less explosive. Yeah, but they're all sort of the same, you know, cobblestones, and you just have to 1-2 minute efforts, and you got to be fresh in the final. That's the most important.
And the atmosphere from the fans is pretty magical. I know the Quaremont, because it's long, it's lined with spectators all the way up. It must be like a corridor of noise when you're riding on those climbs.
Yeah, I remember the first year I did it. It was 2008. It was impressive. Just the fans are so loud, and they like the race. I think that year was really bad weather with maybe 4 or 5 degrees raining, and the fans were standing in lines out on the streets. You know, it's almost so much noise and that you forget to eat, and you're getting really excited, and that's also something you have to learn. You gotta prove it like a normal race, but it's pretty hard because it's so much, there's almost energy in the air.
Now, 2 years ago you had a very bad crash in the Tour of Flanders because you, like a lot of riders do, you were trying to find the best line. You went onto the cycle path and hit a spectator. They've changed the rules now, so you're not supposed to go on the cycle path, but we already saw in Het Nieuwsblad that the rule is very, very difficult to enforce. Yeah. What's your opinion on the rule? Because in that situation, you were just trying to make up some places. Yeah. The cycle path is there for you to use, and it was just an unfortunate moment where the spectator didn't know whether to go forward or back.
Yeah. No, that's true. I think it could be a good rule, but it's really hard because those races, you know, it's... especially the bike paths in Flanders, it's not like some other bike paths. You have a little bump on the road. I think, you know, when they come up with a rule, they have to be clear with it. And I think for the moment, it's not really clear. I think already in this race, they gave somebody a fine for riding on a bike path. That's not the rule. If somebody's on a bike path, you have to take them out of the race. If it's Tom Bonen or Schleck or whatever. Yeah, and this, my crash 2 years ago, it was just bad luck. There was a spectator, he didn't know what to do. I was on the bike path. Like you said, it happens like hundreds of times a day in those races. And it was just bad luck. Not his fault, not my fault. And when they have a rule, got to stick to that.
And the last question then, what's it like being in the final of the race? Is everyone dead? Are you looking at the other riders to get some signs as to who might be the most tired or who would be the ones to follow?
Yeah. The idea is a little bit to try to get as fresh as possible in the final. That's why you have the domestics and guys keep you out of the wind. If you know the parkour, that helps a lot. You know where to save energy. But in the end, it's a 6-7 hour race and on hard roads... not knowing what the wind is doing, and basically you train the whole winter to try to be as fresh as possible in that last 20-25 minutes when it really happens in that final.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney and Daniel Freed.
Well, that was Sebastian Langeveld talking about the Tour of Flanders, and we heard him talk about that crash 2 years ago when he switched from the road onto the cycle path or the pavement and crashed straight into a spectator, and it was a pretty nasty crash. I think he broke his collarbone, and the UCI have tried to clamp down on the riders using either the pavements or the cycle paths. Daniel, what's your view on the rule change?
I think when there is a safety risk, and in that particular case, Langeveld, that illustrated the safety risk because he left the road, I'm hesitate to say that it was his fault, but the spectator that he collided with was certainly taken by surprise, and was standing in quite... It wasn't a single rogue spectator who had stepped out into the road. He was standing in a long line of fans, or certainly there was a gaggle of fans there. I sort of sympathise with the fans in that instance. I mean, whether people using cycle paths to gain an advantage and avoid cobbled sections, I'm probably less bothered about than I would be concerned about the safety of it, and you can see why the UCI have made this move to eradicate it. It's not been observed particularly well so far. I mean, there were long stretches of cobbled road in E3 that the peloton just avoided en masse, switched onto the cycle path. I mean, the kind of directive that they have received, or the indication they've received from the UCI, is if basically a large group of riders goes on the cycle path, then no action will be taken, whereas if it's a single rider, then something will be done.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to enforce, and there's kind of two categories of using a cycle path or a pavement or a gutter perhaps on to avoid the cobbles. As you say, Daniel, that's just kind of picking a sensible line. If you want to ride up the gutter on the Pattersburg or avoid the cobbles on a particular stretch. The Langeveld crash was on a sort of downhill section. There was, from memory, the crowd was standing in the cycle path, and he kind of ducked into it to try and gain places before they reached either one of the other climbs or another section of cobbles, and so trying to move up the peloton by using the cycle path, that's kind of the distinction. But how the commissaires make that distinction in the heat of a race and whether they would apply a disqualification retrospectively, I mean, we are yet to see that happen. We've seen it in Paris-Roubaix in the past where people have ducked under level crossings when the rules are very clear that you're not allowed to duck under a level crossing. You've got to leave it to the commissaires to sort out, reinstate the time gap if appropriate. It just seems to be one of those rules that is going to cause more controversy than solve. So we should have to see how that plays out over the next couple of weeks.
I mean, sometimes, Lionel, we talk about the safety issue I mentioned there. I mean, there are some instances in which the riders are actually making the race safer and making it safer for the spectators by going on cycle paths and avoiding them in that way. But it's interesting to contrast the outrage yesterday at Gent Wevelgem about a photographer lying on the road, an amateur photographer, I don't think it was a professional, lying on the road taking pictures, supposedly endangering the peloton, yet we never hear any great clamour about the danger that riders can pose to spectators if they do stray from the course.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different examples of where riders do take risks. I mean, in the Grand Tours, when they jump up onto a curb section or jump across a curb section to go the other side of a roundabout, you know, that they are dangerous manoeuvres as well. 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100, there's no problem with it. But at what point do the commissaires step in and say that was endangering yourself or others, and that was perfectly safe? So we'll have to see how that plays out. But finally, on Belgium, you're off to the 3 days of Dapana. Have you been before? And if not, what are you expecting?
No, never been before, Lionel. That was why I wanted to go this year. I'm expecting an absolute rotter of a quintessentially Belgian race. A rotter in the sense that it is the race that everyone loves to hate. I mean, even you listen to riders who have done well there. And I spoke to a rider recently who... this actually goes back to the last podcast. I think I mentioned the conversation I'd overheard actually from Alexander Kristoff talking about how he was going to win Milan-San Remo. It'd been the same conversation to one of his teammates. He talked about how he had this love-hate relationship with Dapana, always done incredibly well there, has a fantastic record, despite absolutely hating everything about the race from the first moment to the last. You've been a few times, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I actually really enjoy it for those very same reasons. You can usually rely on one incredibly long stage, 250k, which the riders probably don't like but absolutely need. They crave that distance a few days before the Tour of Flanders. It's kind of the race that the winner of the Dapana never kind of wins the Tour of Flanders. It's one of those kind of unwritten rules that if you win one, you don't win the other. I think perhaps Van Petegem.
I think Van Petegem did in 99, Balan in 2007, but it is rare.
Yeah, very rare. It's usually the weather is terrible, even if Flanders turns out to be on a bright spring sunny day. It's kind of one of those races where the stages start very early. Everyone's in a bit of a grumpy, stressed out mood because they know the roads are going to be narrow, cobbled, the hills, you know, the positioning is everything. There's a real mix of abilities in the field, so it's not just World Tour riders. So the World Tour riders who want to stay safe for Flanders are worried about the kind of the continental team, you know, kamikazes who are there because it's one of their biggest races of the year, particularly for the smaller Belgian team. So they're always the ones that are taking the biggest risks. The final day is unpopular because it's a split stage. There's a road race in the morning and then the time trial in the afternoon. Now, I personally love it because you see the road race finish in the morning. There's time for a waffle with hot chocolate sauce while the time trial's going on. There's a kind of a sense of relief, really, in the afternoon that everyone's kind of got through it. And then the countdown to Flanders really begins. But it's just a race where the fans turn out in big numbers in Dapana, not a particularly big seaside town, but it always feels really buzzy, and it's kind of like you can feel the sort of the drums beating towards the Tour of Flanders. So I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, and one of the questions I'm interested to ask when I'm over there or find out about is what future the race has, because the trend seems to be for Tour of Flanders contenders to compete less and less often in Dapana. This year, if you look at the start list, Sagan is riding, but The most of the other main contenders are giving it a miss, and even some of the main teams this year are giving it a miss. Garmin decided 3 or 4 years ago, Garmin Shop decided 3 or 4 years ago, that it was too dangerous and not really necessary. They could replicate the same efforts in training. Sky aren't riding this year. And like you say, there are a number of, probably almost half the field is sort of minor Belgian teams this year.
Well, over to Spain then, or more to the point, Catalonia. The Catalonians won't be too happy with me describing it as Spain. The Grand Tour riders have been racing, and if you look at the top six in the Tour of Catalonia, it's basically a who's who of stage racers, isn't it? Joaquim Rodriguez won it for Katusha. He was ahead of Alberto Contador, who continues his fine spring. TJ Van Garderen was third. He won the kind of queen stage, the big mountain stage of the race. Then there was Romain Bardet of Agir d'Air. Daniel, you'll be delighted about that. Young French rider doing well. Nairo Quintana and Chris Froome were the other riders in the top six. And then even in seventh place, Andrew Talansky. So it really was a kind of a snapshot of what we can expect in the Grand Tours later in the summer. Did you see much of that race at all?
Not a huge amount. And, you know, I felt that, I mean, it didn't probably live up to the precedent of last year's. Was very exciting where Dan Martin took a real sort of opportunist stage win and then held on for the overall victory in quite a dramatic last stage. I spoke to some of the guys who were out the race and they said that yesterday's stage in the rain in Barcelona did turn into the proverbial damp squib because of the weather. Louis Westra won from Astana, but not too much happened on general classification as far as general classification was concerned. And Rodriguez just keeps going on and on, doesn't he? 34 now, I think I'm right in saying. And again, is going to be a major factor in the major tours this year. I interviewed him recently and talked with him mainly actually about his regrets, because he has quite a few, especially the 2012 Giro, which was the closest probably he's come to winning a Grand Tour, in addition to the Vuelta that he also narrowly lost out on that year, and Contador pipped him, and also the World Championships last year when, for infamously now, Valverde didn't chase Rui Costa. Rui Costa took the gold medal, caught Rodriguez in the last 500 metres, and that was really, you know, up until 3 or 4 weeks ago, that was really still eating Joaquim Rodriguez up, and he thought that you'll probably never get over that. But he certainly, I don't know whether he's used it as motivation, but he certainly looks to be in good form.
Yeah, Rodriguez, is his big target this year is the Giro d'Italia, as you say, second 2 years ago to Ryder Heisedal. He's interesting because it wasn't until he was 30 that he really cracked Grand Tour riding. He didn't finish in the top 10 of any of the big three stage races until 2009 when he was 30. And since then, he's basically been good for a top 10 finish in every single season, whether it be the Giro, the Vuelta or the Tour like last year. But he's going back to the Giro, which strikes me as probably the one he's got most chance of winning looking at the parcours, because although there is a long flat time trial, which is really his bete noire, the second time trial in the Giro is a mountainous one, and you know, any time that he loses in the flat one, you know, he's going to limit losses in the mountainous one. So a race like Catalonia with the uphill finishes, perfect way for him to get his sort of Grand Tour preparation on the move, and I think we'll see probably more of the same from him at the Tour of the Basque Country, which is between the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, isn't it? So the other thing that struck me from the Tour of Catalonia was the emergence of another giant Shimano sprinter, Luka Mezec, a Slovenian, has I think won three stages there. He won the Handzema Classic in Belgium, a small kind of, not even a semi-classic, a couple of weeks ago. Three stages in Catalonia now. Add to that John Degenkolb's victory in Gent-Wevelgem. Add to that Tom Dumoulin winning a time trial at the Criterium International in Corsica. Giant Shimano, a team of the moment at the moment.
Yeah, I personally wouldn't get too excited about Mezec in Catalonia, because the level of sprinting, level of sprinter there was pretty low. No disrespect to the sprinters that were there, but none of the big boys certainly took part there.
Thing is, people said that about Mark Cavendish in 2007, didn't they?
Well, that is true. just on Giant Shimano, actually, this is my weekly opportunity to talk about Roger De Vlaeminck. Roger De Vlaeminck, I was told, was absolutely disgusted that Marcel Kittel didn't ride Milan San Remo. He said if he doesn't think he can get over the Cipressa, he shouldn't be a professional cyclist.
I think we're going to have to start limiting the De Vlaeminck mentions each week, but we'll let you get away with that one. The other two stage races going on, I said it was very busy. Criterium International in Corsica, the last one to be held in Corsica. It's been there a few years now. Probably the high watermark for that race was last year when all of the top teams went because the Tour de France was starting in Corsica. This year, a much lower level of field. Another win for Nasser Bouhanni in the opening sprint stage, and an overall victory for Jean-Christophe Perrault, but not a great deal else to mention from there. But over in Italy, the Coppi Bartali race, a race that has it takes its name from two of the absolute legends of cycling, and yet it's quite a peculiar four-day race in Italy. Tell us a bit about it. I don't know very much about it at all. I've not been.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a few times, and the first stage is traditionally, well, it's a crit, really. It's about 100 kilometres, short laps with a hill on the circuit, always ends in a sprint. And there is always, well, usually a team time trial later that afternoon, and two or three stages, I forget whether it's 4 or 5 days now, I think it's 5 days, and it's some fairly hilly, tricky stages in the Apennines in central Italy. So the race is based in Rimini, Riccione, where famously Marco Pantani was from, his old stomping ground. But the terrain in land from there is very mountainous, very hilly, and that's where the race is really concentrated. And Peter Kenyuk won very impressively. Sky completely dominated. Cataldo actually quite surprised me with his time trial yesterday, won it very convincingly the final time trial, but the level there was not great either. Beyond Sky, a lot of fairly minor teams taking part. It's actually a bit of a surprise to me that race has managed to survive. It's a bit of an anomaly in terms of small Italian stage races in that it has survived. It's got some very wealthy sort of local backers, and I'm told that they have really saved it, bankrolled it in the last 3 or 4 years.
Just the fact that it's named after Fausto Coppi and Gino Bartali, does that add some lustre to it? Is that one of the reasons perhaps that it has survived?
In a word, no. I don't think so. It's a bit of a strange one, that, because
Fine. Okay. Well, the other big race of the weekend was the second round of the Women's World Cup, the Trofeo Alfredo Binder, named after another legendary Italian rider, someone who I always associate with toe straps, because they were always Binder toe straps. Yeah. Emma Johansson of Sweden won that. Lizzie Armitstead of Great Britain second, and she extends her lead in the overall World Cup classification. The next round of that will be the Tour of Flanders, held on the weekend of the Tour of Flanders, this weekend coming up. So we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks' time, because next week we've got a Paris-Roubaix special. Myself, Daniel and Richard will
be... Lots of Roger De Vlaeminck in that, isn't there?
There's lots of Roger De Vlaeminck in that as well. Mr. Paris-Roubaix, Roger De Vlaeminck. He doesn't make an appearance, though, unfortunately, but we have got a contender to...
I might see him in Dipana. Very good chance I'll see him in Dipana.
If you see him in Dipana, you have to
I'm
speak
sure
to
I'm sure I'll see Freddie Martins, because that's Freddie Martins' neck of the woods.
It is, yeah. He still works in the Tour of Flanders Museum down in Oudenaarde, so I'm sure he'll make an appearance there at some point. But yeah, next week we've got the Paris-Roubaix special. We'll be hearing from Tom Boonen, a contender for Roger De Vlaeminck's Mr. Paris-Roubaix title, and also Sean Kelly, who 30 years ago in 1984 won his first Paris-Roubaix. So look out for that one next week. In the meantime, the Tour of Britain route for the 2014 race is being launched a little later on. I'm off there shortly, and we'll hear from some of the people there in a minute.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
Well, the 2014 Tour of Britain starts in Liverpool with a city centre circuit on September the 7th and finishes in London a week later with a time trial and a criterium. And on the way, it goes to Llandudno, which is taking in... It's going to look like an episode of Coast, I think, going around Great Orme there. There's a stage finish on the Tumble, which if anyone remembers the 1989 Kellogg's Tour of Britain, they'll remember Robert Miller's Great Escape there. There's the now traditional stage in Dartmoor. Something that's very interesting for me is a stage finish in Hemel Hempstead, where I went to school. And to mark perhaps the 20th anniversary of the Tour de France visiting Britain in 1994, the race will also go over Ditchling Beacon on its way to Brighton before that finish in London. I'm with Mick Bennett, the tour director, who's put this route together. Mick, what particularly stands out for you from the week of racing we've got this year?
I think probably there's many points, actually. The bookends of two circuit races, if you like. The start in Liverpool, the last time we were there was 2008, and we were inundated with the many, many spectators that came out. That was quite an iconic day, I think, for Liverpool, because that's steeped in cycling history. But I think the stage that probably stands out, and you mentioned it earlier, the Robert Miller stage up the Tumble, 7%, an absolute brute of a climb, and you get the crosswinds halfway up it. After that awful ramp up to begin with, I think that'll be the defining moment of the race. There's many other points, as the iconic circumnavigation of the Great Orme in Llandudno before, you know, pre that we go through Conway and the lovely castle and that backdrop. But the whole finish right on that coastline up in North Wales will be pretty stunning as well. And there are many things, you know, you factor in the finish onto the top of Bristol Downs there, down the Avon Valley Gorge with the wonderful Brunel Bridge in the backdrop and that 1 kilometre brute of a climb inside the last 3Ks. There's so much. It's so rich this year, the ingredients. It could be won and lost anywhere, right down to the wire in Ditchling Beacon.
Indeed. Well, I remember Ditchling Beacon very well from the Tours visit in 94 and also the World Cup race, the Wincanton Classic that was in Brighton. You were saying earlier in the evening when you were unveiling the route that you have to be a little bit cute as race director because you don't want it all done and dusted. And you were talking about the stage in Llandudno there where Great Orme could potentially end the race on stage two before it's really had a chance to get going. So as race director, you have to strike all of these different balances, not least with a look at the map here. We're a very western Tour of Britain this year, and I can already hear the people in Scotland mentioning that no Tour of Britain can be complete without a visit to Scotland. So just explain a little bit about how you strike all of those different balances.
Well, I think I call it on, although it was in a different era, my experience as a pro being there for 9 years, and believe me, when we do recce and I look at the climbs, I am actually visualising myself going through the pain of some of the climbs, having ridden tours in the past, and I suppose that does help. And I thought with the particular climb of the Great Orme, which you mentioned, there was the temptation to put it into the top of the Great Orme was such a temptation, and I went there twice and looked at it and photographed it and walked it and rode it and drove it, and I thought, no, it's too much. It is genuinely too much. The race would split into several pockets, which means that for the spectator and for televisually, the race effectively would be down to a hard group of probably half a dozen riders. And the ideal thing for me would be to get to the final time trial in London, although it's only 9 kilometres, and not have the race decided on GC, if you like. There might be a leader going into with a few seconds lead. So there's always that creation. It's like being and I was a chef, it's like having all this ingredients to play with and coming up with the best cake you can bake. And I always say that I think this is the best cake this year.
Well, last year's was pretty spectacular. You had the first summit finish at Haytor. This year, the summit finish at the Tumble strikes me as a much harder climb than Haytor, and could well be the decisive moment of the race. But then there's still Dartmoor as well, which is not going to be easy. Although it finishes in Exeter, there's a lot of climbing there. And as you said, Ditchling Beacon. you were talking a bit about how no doors are closed to the Tour of Britain now. Maybe 8-10 years ago it would have been hard to get all of these roads closed and all of these various local authorities on side, but this year you really are able to put together the route you really want.
Yeah, and if you like, you know, choose your ingredients again. And bear in mind that there's quite a lot of pressure on not just a venue to come up with the funding or a region to come up with the funding, but also to put the closures in that we need. And you take the stage, the stage seven, the penultimate day, one of our longest days, 224 kilometres into Brighton. They're actually taking out the roundabout on Madeira Drive so that we can circumnavigate it safely, because you're within the last 500 metres. Those are the sort of pressures that the race puts on a host. And they are willing to do that. They often say, are our roads good enough for you to race on? And we say, you know, you should see Paris-Roubaix and Tour of Flanders and some of the Belgian classics if you want to see bad roads. But, you know, at the end of the day, we say the roads here, listen, I live in Surrey and the roads are pretty shot after all the flooding, but they're perfectly good to race on. If a rider goes down on a bad road surface, it's deemed a sporting incident. So, you know, there is pressure on a local authority to host the event in terms of the closures, the infrastructure that we need. And because of the growth of the Tour of Britain and now live coverage, the live OB section is about half the size of a football pitch. All has to be contained within an area. So invariably, we're finishing more outside of city centres, and it's quite rare today that a city centre can actually accommodate the race in all of its glory. And it's become technically very difficult, which becomes technically challenging for the venues to put the races on as well.
Now, the race is moving up to all category ranking with the UCI this year. That makes it one of the biggest stage races in the world. You mentioned that the transfers after stages have been reduced quite dramatically. I mean, I've been one of the critics of the long transfers in the past.
Yes,
but,
you have.
But I can also see
yes,
the
you
point.
Have
yes, yes, I know you're saying yes, I have. Yeah, I did once add up that the transfers were longer than the stages on one of the years. Yes,
yeah.
Sorry, Mick. Do you sometimes feel damned if you do, damned if you don't? Because obviously last year was quite an eastern side. You visited Norfolk and Suffolk in the last couple of years. This year is very western, and Wales is very well represented. No Scotland, of course. And as I joked earlier, you know, people. It's a testimony to the race, I suppose, that people who aren't getting a visit this year will. There'll be howls of complaint. But you've already talked about trying to balance it up over the next 5 years. You've got a 5-year contract to develop the race. So you'll be looking at other areas on a kind of rolling basis?
Yeah, yes, no, we are doing that. And but, you know, to go back to the track, it's not as if we put them in there out of choice. And people forget that I've been a pro. I know what it's like. I don't have the big luxury coaches that never raced in those days. But I know what it's like to finish a stage knackered, to have to sit in a car and drive 4 hours to get to the finish, to get to your hotel. But we always said that our teams will be in their hotel by 7 o'clock at night, and that's we've vowed to do that. They are fantastic hotels. Yes, we've had long transfers in the past. And my reaction to the likes of yourself when it's been criticised is that we don't do it because we want to throw pain and anguish at the riders after the day. It's because it's a necessity. We've got 8 days to move this, and the funding partners that fund it want the finish there. You factor in a Friday night transfer at 5 o'clock at night in rush hour in this country on the roads that we've got. You get a snarl up on the M25 or the M4 or the A303. You're in absolute... There's nothing you can do about it.
Well, you're stuck in the traffic as well, I suppose,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah, we're monitoring with the AA and the RAC and the police the best routes. And we're advising the teams who are calling us and asking us, what are the best routes at the moment? Where are they? And sometimes we escort the teams. But I would advocate that the teams have always been sat down between 7 and 8 o'clock at night for their evening meal, regardless of how long the transfers are, Lionel. Mm. And I know that some of the stage races, they're there at midnight.
They are.
Sat down to dinner, yeah.
Yeah, I'll testify to that. Usually it's journalists waiting to interview them and delaying their dinner. Yes. Just lastly then, because the Hemel Hempstead stage particularly interested me, are you going around the Magic Roundabout there? They've got one of those.
No, we looked at the Magic Roundabout, yeah. We thought that was just too confusing. We actually are north of the Magic Roundabout. But we did. It was considered. It's about a mile and a half away, I think, there, and it's on the main road out. And you've got the big park on the right. I forget what the park.
Gaybridge Park.
Gaybridge
I tell you.
Park. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, yeah, on the right hand side.
So, talk me through just briefly. How does a town like Hemel Hempstead get a finish of the Tour of Britain? Because I didn't know before I got here this evening. A very pleasant surprise for me personally.
Okay.
I'm really looking forward to it. I can stay at my own house. I live not too far away that evening. But how does a town go about getting a stage finish of the Tour of Britain or a start?
It's ever so simple. They apply to us. And if it fits within the geography of where we're taking the race that year, it's not unusual that they won't get it. But they literally apply. And we've got applications and people we've had to turn down. If they don't get a stage finish, they'll apply for a tour series. And that's the joy of the tour series, which is the other series for domestic teams in this country that has sort of compensated those venues that can't either afford or have the race that year.
Well, it's going to be a great lineup this year, I think, with the HC status. You're going to get, you know, a lot of the World Tour teams applying to be part of the race, not just being invited, but actually wanting to be part of the race. But also, you've made sure that there's still a home here for the Great Britain national team and the domestic teams as well, because I gather you think that's important to allow them to take part still.
It's always been important since 2004. I've been in the days of the Kellogg's Tour when the World Cup teams shut the race down on our roads, and it's destroyed the racing. And I think we've always kept this open view that you have continental, pro-continental and World Tour teams of an equal balance really does animate the event. And it's interesting that over the last several years now, the animators of the race right from word from get-go have been the British continental riders. And you've only got to look at how well they do. There was many of them have the leaders' jerseys going into the final day. And because it's the pinnacle of the season for them. And why not? They can shake it all up like Simon Yates did on Hay Tour. He really shook the race, grabbed it and shook it apart. And look at him now. He's got a fantastic contract with Orica Greenedge. So we will always try to strike that balance and not have... We could have the whole event have World Tour teams in it, but we don't want it.
Mick Bennett, thank you very much.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
Well, that's all from this week's edition of the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. We'll be back next week with our Paris-Roubaix special. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thanks, Lionel.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.